and Reverend Francis Deverall, who's our visiting minister this morning, would like to share a story with you, a story for all ages.
Hello. Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. My name is Rev Francis, and I have come to visit you all the way from Ottawa, the capital of Canada. Did you know that already? Oh, I can't tell you a thing. Okay. Okay, I have a question for you. Have you ever heard of climate change? No? Some of you have? No? Haven't heard of climate change? Some of you have. Okay. What does anybody know about it? Maybe I should give you just a little quick, since that's my topic today, I think I should just give you a little quick. Climate change means the world is getting warmer and the weather is changing. And it's going to be a problem if we let it get too warm too fast. So that's what I've come to talk about today. And my question is, I wonder what I, as an individual, can do to make a difference about something really big like climate change. I wonder how old I have to be to take action.
About 20.
Oh, maybe 20 would be good. That sounds good. I wonder what we can do together. I wonder what it would be like to live in a way that values the earth and all its creatures. Is that one of the promises you know, that we'll live together with the earth in a way that values all its creatures? Is that something you learn here in this church? I know they do in the Beacon Church that I'm going to be preaching in next Sunday. It's easy to worry sometimes about things you have no control over, but it feels better if we can take some action. And my message to you today is that we do have the power to choose what we are going to do with our time, with our skills, with our knowledge, with our lives. We have the power to choose. And so today I want to talk to you about a few people who made some choices because they wanted to make a difference and help us live in better harmony with the earth. So the first example is actually myself, and I'm going to talk about an action I took 2 weeks ago at the beginning of October. I and my friends from Toronto were fasting on Parliament Hill. That means some of us weren't, if we were... Oh, you have cousins in Toronto? Oh, I have a brother in Toronto, too. Yes. So these people came all the way to Ottawa for 5 days to fast on Parliament Hill. What does that mean, to fast? Okay. Some of my friends didn't have anything to eat for 5 days. That's what they did for their fast. I was carbon fasting, so I was trying not to use any energy based on fossil fuels, like oil and coal. So I was riding my bike all over the place and hanging my laundry out to dry and not eating meat and things like that. So we were there for 5 days because we really wanted our leaders to know that it's time to make change. Very big. So one day, we had all my friends up onto Parliament Hill, and I want to show you a picture of us up there. I'm going to let you hand it around so you can all look at it because it's too small. Can't show it to all of you, but I'll give you the image. The Raging Grannies were there, and Chris White, one of my favorite singers, and Tony Turner, and we had a festival, a climate festival, and we sang songs about action and climate change and what we had to do about it, and it was really fun. Sometimes taking action can be fun. And our goal was to have 15 letters to every member of parliament in Canada every first of the month. Climate first on the first of the month. Now, another story. 2 years ago in January, five First Nations teenage boys who live way up in northern Canada decided, with their grandfather's help, to walk all the way from their home in the far north in January and February to Ottawa to talk to our leaders, to tell them they had to do something about climate change. What could be so important that they would walk so far they would need two sets of boots and warm socks because the first set wore out along the way? Whoa! They were desperate to see healing and good homes and enough food for the people in their community. And so they really needed to make a noise to get some attention about the problems in their community. So they walked through the cold winter for more than 3 months. They had to wear snowshoes because the snow was deep. And they had a sled they put their stuff on, and it was carried by a dog team. And along the way, they stopped in every First Nations community they arrived in, and those people put them up and fed them and made them warm. And they told stories and they talked about their communities, and then more people joined the walk. So by the time they got to Ottawa, there was quite a crowd. And by doing that, they grew up into adults. They took charge of their lives. They decided they weren't going to let other people decide anymore for them how they were going to live. They were going to make something happen. Last year, I heard a story on the radio of a young 14-year-old girl in Africa who was lucky enough to be able to go to school. For her science project, she invented a way to make electricity out of her own pee. Can you believe that? Isn't that funny? Yeah. And this year, I heard the story of a grade 11 student who won a science prize for inventing a way to take all the bad pollution out of the tailings ponds in the oil sands. Imagine a girl being able to do that. What creativity and powers of invention do we have if we only study hard in school and develop our talents so that we can put our gifts to work on the problems in the world? In Nelson, British Columbia, a young girl was studying about climate change in science, and she found out that there was a real problem and nobody was doing anything about it. So she got really upset, and she started talking to her friends and talking to her neighbors and talking to her teachers and talking to anybody who would listen, and driving everybody absolutely bonkers. And she got help, and the community started to work together. And they made a full-length feature movie called The Change Agents. I hope you all decide to watch it. Put it on for a movie night at the church, because it's really a good movie they made. And they made a movie that has the potential to educate a whole generation of kids that they have power and they can do something. I dream that we are living through a time of great change when we will reinvent how to live together with this precious earth and all the living things on it. Because of all these actions that these people and many other people have been doing, the leaders are starting to listen. But if we don't keep at them, they'll forget. So we have to keep at them. I wonder what you dream about doing. I wonder what changes you want to see. I wonder what special gifts you have to contribute. I bet you have a few. Energy, definitely one of them. I hope you will believe in your good ideas and act on them. Thanks so much. It was a great honor for me to receive an invitation from Christine Johnston to come west to reflect on our Canadian Unitarians for Social Justice. Some of you may know that I attended the Beacon Unitarian Church for many years and that I was the minister for a brief period of time at Capitol, and that I did my internship at the North Shore and occasionally preached at Vancouver. So I feel very connected to the BC region. My baptism by fire into the social justice conversations of Unitarians in Canada was a controversy at the Regina Unitarian Fellowship over walking with our banner in a peace march. I thought peace marches were like applehood, apple pie, and motherhood and things like that, you know, just a no-brainer. I couldn't believe that we couldn't bring our faith witness to a peace parade. But some of our elders had fought in the Second World War, and there was no way they were having the Unitarian banner in the same parade as communists. Apparently, Unitarians had a very activist phase during the 1960s when we were burgeoning and growing like crazy. We were passionately present and in the news on many issues. The Reverends Bill Jenkins and John Morgan frequently saw their entire sermons printed in the newspaper. They made such controversial pronouncements. Mac Elrod, one of our elders in this church, was one of those kinds of ministers, and he was busy bringing war draft dodgers in from the Vietnam War and fighting the drug issue and all those things. Finally, in the 1970s, more moderate and conservative Unitarians began to complain that they didn't entirely agree with all of the positions that were being taken. Our congregation started to experience unpleasant conflicts. I think it may have even caused a few splits. We began to search for ways to live together with different views of what social justice is. I've been part of this conversation now for at least 7 different congregations. For many, it seemed easier to stop talking social justice and focus on spirituality, as if one could live without the other. To some people, we became a faith community that wasn't walking its talk. To others, the solution was to go out and do your social justice work as an individual in the community, working for the food bank or the women's shelter or for Amnesty International or some other way. Social justice committees met and experimented. Some focused on educational events. We invented movie nights and forums. The forums, people could hear all the different points of view at the same event and then make up their own mind. We ran letter-writing campaigns so that every individual could have their own point of view and express it and take action without any conflict resulting. Occasionally, a champion would bring everyone together around an issue or an obvious need. The best example that comes to mind is the Nanaimo Fellowship, somehow or other all coming together to turn their building into a homeless shelter in the wintertime. At Beacon, Sandy Burpee led us to work on Together Against Violence, but he wasn't entirely satisfied because while he was out there representing the congregation and the community, he didn't bring many of us with him. I have often heard the complaint, when social action leads, the community doesn't follow. But were the members unengaged, or were they all just working on different issues? This weakness in our process, this lack of common voice, has led us to have a deep hunger in our movement for a visible Unitarian voice. And we've really tried to search to figure out what to do about it. The Canadian Unitarian Council continued to host resolutions on social issues at every annual general meeting, but often nothing happened after the resolution was passed. We designed and redesigned processes to make sure our positions were more grounded in the congregations and to make sure that some action would actually result. We established monitoring groups to follow important issues. It was very hard to get more than one or two people to stay on an issue and keep working at it from right across the country. Our most effective presence has probably been felt on rights for GLBTQ people. Thanks to Art Brewer, the champion in Toronto, about 98% of Unitarians today belong to a welcoming congregation. And our presence on the gay marriage issue was felt very clearly at the committee level in Parliament when the Parliament decided to go for gay marriage. Another issue that we've had clear voice on for a long time is the choice in dying issue. Thanks to Brian Kiley, who ran a solid curriculum for a year, and then Anne Treadwell and Vita Ng working on keeping that issue in the forefront of the Unitarian minds, we have made our voice heard on that issue. We have had intervener status in court cases. We've really had a positive effect. It is worth noting that on both the GLBTQ issues and the choice in dying issues, we had an active presence on the issue for decades. We had a solid consensus in our congregations and among ministers, which is important, and active champions. In hindsight, I'm thinking that our little bit of a debacle on the Palestinian question last May was a lesson to us that opening our mouths without first building our consensus is somewhat risky. On the other hand, sometimes you have to take risks, and if you want to stir the pot, and we certainly did stir the pot. People are talking about it all over the country, so maybe that was okay. For Unitarians, it takes discernment and hard work to build that consensus, and great compassion, because different points of view come from very real places. The Canadian Unitarian Council will launch yet another round of discussions on how we do social action next year in May. In 1995, Mike Harris brought the common sense revolution to Ontario and slashed Ontario's social programs. Ontario Unitarians went into shock. Across Toronto, the Catholic bishops and the Interfaith Social Assistance Reform Coalition were speaking out. Everyone was asking, where are the Unitarians? Social activists in Toronto decided to take matters into their own hands by creating a new organization that was more free to speak out, the Canadian Unitarians for Social Justice, of which I was president for about 5 years. Most recently, I'm the past president now. At first, it was a coalition of activists from all congregations in the Toronto area. Later, Paul Martin's cuts at the federal level helped us spread our organization across the entire country. Just News, edited first by Mel Johnson in this congregation and now for the last 10 years by Philip Simons, published our take on key social issues and took time to do a deeper level of reflection on some of them. It also raised the profile of different congregations and what they were doing around the country, so we tried to make ourselves known to each other. During the year, our membership stayed connected through a listserv. The board wrote letters on many issues and have always been involved in protecting human rights, especially for those unjustly affected by the net of 9/11, Mohamed Harkat in Montreal, Hassan Diab in Ottawa, and Omar Khadr now in Edmonton, of most recent note. I came to the board during a time of low energy. Our numbers and our finances had been falling, and we weren't developing new leadership. People had moved past that era of crisis, and they didn't really know why we needed Canadian Unitarians for Social Justice. We had to go through a period of hard administrative slogging, renewing our membership practices, developing the current version of our website, making our work more visible. We started a Facebook page that now has 220 members. We've worked to improve our networks, and we've joined outside coalitions like the Housing Coalition across the country, the Climate Action Network. Our activists across the country have had a strong presence for peace in the Middle East. The CUSJ policy statement is currently the only public Unitarian witness on the rights of Palestinians. I am proud that we have it out there. So perhaps this is the special role of CUSJ in our movement, to be the voice of conscience when the larger movement is not yet ready to speak. Another special role for CUSJ is to take political action when necessary. Some issues like the Kinder Morgan and the Gateway pipelines, tanker traffic in Haida Gwaii, we recently had a nice warning about that. Line 9 in Toronto and Energy East in Ottawa require us to stand on the line and stop those developments, even if you may be arrested. Peaceful, nonviolent protest. Climate change and oil sand development, in my view, are that kind of issue. And I'm so proud of our West Coast chapter operating out of the North Shore in British Columbia, which I hope some of you belong to, and Toronto congregations for their visible presence on these issues. I was shocked to learn that there had been rallies of over 3,000 people in Vancouver, and they weren't even covered in the national news in Ontario. It's truly a David and Goliath battle to call our leaders to account for Canada's contribution to climate change. But even as I am proud of our achievements, we are constantly reviewing what we are doing to improve our effectiveness. Our hearts are filled with compassion for the people and the animals of this world and the threats that they face. We see growing tensions and challenges around the whole world that must be addressed if civilization as we know it is to survive and develop. I notice that our American colleagues agree with me, because they have gathered a huge collective initiative on climate change. They're making it the highest imaginable priority for all organizations, the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee, the UUA, the UUUNO, the Earth Justice Group. They're gathering together. They're going to try and make a big difference. I'd like to see us join them. We must get better at what we do. We must find the key to unlocking our passions and help to make a difference in a world that is going to be facing turmoil. I'm going to take a pause and invite you to have a moment of quiet with yourself, to think about your own involvement, what you do, and what you'd like to be doing. You have been telling the people that this is the 11th hour. Now you must go and tell the people that this is the hour, and there are things to be considered.
Where are you living? What are you doing? What are your relationships? Are you in the right relationship? Where is your water? Know your garden.
It is time to speak your truth. Create your community. Be good to each other. Do not look outside of yourself for a leader.
There is a river flowing now very fast. It is so great and swift that there are those who will be afraid. They will try to hold on to the shore. They will feel they are being pulled apart and will suffer greatly.
Understand that the river knows its destination. The elders say we must let go of the shore, push off into the middle of the river, keep our eyes open and our heads above water.
And I say, see who is in there with you. Hold fast to them and celebrate.
At this time in history, we are to take nothing personally, least of all ourselves. For the moment we do, our spiritual growth and journey comes to an end. The time of the lone wolf is over.
Gather yourselves. Banish the word struggle from your attitude and vocabulary. All that we do now must be done in a sacred manner and in celebration.
We are all about to go on a journey. We are the ones we have been waiting for. It is such a privilege to work with Philip in person. He's been on the board of CUSJ all the time that I've been there. We're so lucky with the dedicated activists that we have, and Maria as well, backing him up all the way and taking her own initiatives. Everyone here already knows all the challenges and potential crises we face. I don't have to do the litany. Our reading invites us to become engaged, to jump into the river and let it carry us without knowing where it's going, to note who is swimming with us and to celebrate them. That's why I love being a Unitarian. That's who I'm swimming with. We all watch the ongoing tension between the dream of democracy and the fear of totalitarianism. One day I think maybe democracy around the world is growing and flourishing. We have Occupy and Arab Spring and Idle No More and Quebec's version of the spring, Maple Spring, and it seems wonderful. And then we see the clampdown all over the place. Then I start thinking that even in Canada, our democracy is under attack. Political conversation today happens in 8-word sound bites, and it just seems like the general population doesn't get it. Could Toronto really re-elect Rob Ford by proxy through his brother Doug? So hard to believe. We all watch while the government gives the oil sector every possible subsidy and tax break. Harper blithely goes on planning to triple production in the oil sands and pipe it out in 5 different directions to markets in Europe, USA, and Asia. Canada's railway engineers are falling asleep at the wheel, and Harper does nothing to adequately regulate them and make sure they're properly staffed with these high-speed toxic trains, even after the accident at Lac-Mégantic. Enbridge's Line 9 has been somewhat delayed because they have only installed 6 out of 104 mandated safety valves required to ensure a spill won't be too damaging to our Great Lakes. After the Gulf of Mexico fiasco, the oil industry continues to cut corners, and we let them. Our governments completely ignore the fact. I never hear it in the news, except recently from Mark Carney, that we have to leave 4/5 of this oil in the ground. Wasn't that amazing when Mark Carney came out with that? Wow. He, in case you are not familiar, is the governor of the Bank of England, former governor of the Bank of Canada. I mean, that's somebody who really knows. The corporations are only mandated to consider profit. The only value at the center of our economic system is greed. According to David Miller, current CEO of the World Wildlife Fund and former mayor of Toronto, we have lost 52% of the wildlife in the oceans, land, and air in the last 40 years. 52%. The cause? Loss of habitat caused by climate change and the practices of our extractive industries. We know what the issues are, and we also know what the answers are. We know that the world can convert to 100% renewable energy by 2050 if we start now and really work at it. We know that a price on carbon will assist people to make the best possible choices. We know that the government has the capacity to shift subsidies and tax levers so that renewable energy is promoted and carbon energy is discouraged. Right now, if you put in a new high-efficiency furnace to burn natural gas, you can often get a subsidy, at least in Ontario. I don't know about BC. But if you try and put in a heat pump, you get nothing. We know that we can do these things if we have the political will. But we don't have the political will. So we know that the most important action we can take is to build that political will. We know that people can build the community they want. Renewable energy is more accepted if initiated by the community. It can't be laid on people from the top down. This is the story of our wind resistance, right? That it's being laid on people in ways that they didn't participate in the decision-making to make it happen. The great turning, as David Corton called it, will not be initiated by the Harper government, or even a Mulcair government, or a Trudeau government. The government can't do it for us. We will need the creativity, innovation, hard work, and some sacrifice from all of us, the workers, the engineers, the professionals, the students, everyone, to make these changes. When the people decide that their legacy for their grandchildren must be a life-sustaining planet, they will do what it takes to make this happen. Our biggest challenge is to help people realize that they can make a difference with what they do. Between elections, how can we exercise our rights as citizens of a democracy except by talking with and writing to politicians? Or occasionally standing in the streets or on the line against pipelines. Every letter, every phone call, every visit counts. Every conversation across your kitchen table with family and friends counts. That's sometimes the most difficult work. Years ago in sales, I learned a fascinating lesson. When I was actively working to sell my services, making calls, sending brochures, cold calling potential clients, I made sales, but often not to the people that I was actually directly approaching. Someone would call and want my services. But if I wasn't actively selling, sales dried up. When you set your intention and put it into motion in the world, with as simple an action as writing a letter. It has an effect. Do you think Harper read my letter? What impact did my check for $50 have on the court case against the FIPA? Did my film night on climate change make a difference? Who would have imagined 5 years ago that neither the XL pipeline nor the gateway would be built today? We didn't think we could really win, did we? And we haven't won yet, but we haven't lost either. When CUSJ meets as a board, we try to understand what kind of action to take. For many years, we wrote letters. Now we begin to see that we must do more than that. We must be better than that. How many of you were aware that last year, the CUSJ board wrote the president of every Unitarian congregation in Canada recommending that they consider divestment from fossil fuels as an unethical investment? Can you raise your hand if you knew we did that? Quite a few of you do. I'm impressed. We had a few responses. One congregation that I'm aware of actually took it to an annual meeting and voted to divest. What happened to the rest? We learned that a letter has to be followed with a phone call and maybe another letter. We need to involve social justice and environment committees because this process is going to happen by a conversation in every congregation from the bottom up. Change happens organically from within. I think maybe the same is true for our politicians. You know, they are also surrounded by a group of people who are influencing their decisions, and somehow or other we have to be part of that wider conversation around them in order to, they will rise up and do the right thing when enough people make them. CUSJ decided to become a real supporter of Climate Fast because it seemed like a really good symbolic gesture that people could rally to. For one thing, it invites people to see that climate change is about life itself. It's a spiritual imperative to do something about this. It's really not okay to do nothing. It's a different kind of action. Instead of writing one letter, we're actually calling everyone to write letters. We have this Climate First on the First of the Month campaign, and our goal is that politicians of every stripe will be inundated with the demands to put a price on carbon, to get rid of the subsidies on oil, and to focus on renewable energy. It's the simplest basic ask, and everybody actually agrees that it might even take us a long way. It won't be enough by itself, but it would take us a long way in the right direction. People keep telling Margaret Rao and myself that what we are doing is important. Margaret comes to Parliament Hill and fasts with me. She's the current president of CUSJ. Our chapters have affirmed every year that they want to keep doing it. I cannot tell you how much it matters when we put out the call and we hear back from you that you are writing letters. You give us heart to keep going, that it's working. Just thinking about problems like climate change can send us into a spiral of despair. It's especially hard when we find ourselves always standing against things that everybody else seems to be okay with. I could be on Parliament Hill 3 times a day, 7 days a week. There's so much demonstration and protest going on in that place. It's spiritually draining to be constantly on the defensive, standing up to stop what we don't want. That is why it is so important to continually reassess. Are we working in the best way? What new possibilities are there to explore? What actions should we consider? Our First Nations are a real inspiration to us right now. I hear of so many groups holding services. Has this group had a connection with the First Nations in their community? I would be shocked if you hadn't. I hear of so many groups doing this. Our new study process, being developed by Meg Roberts in Comox, is going to encourage even more of this. By their very presence among us, they hold an alternate vision of how we can live with the earth. It is my prayer that we may be changed by our interaction with First Nations, and that our society may move towards a more holistic philosophical foundation based on an interdependent relationship with the earth and with all beings. Naomi Klein, in her new book, which I'm sure is buzzing around this community, she talks anti-capitalism. I talk putting the right values at the center of whatever economic system we have. Perhaps capitalism could be modified to include a triple bottom line, people, planet, profit, instead of just the profit bottom line. But the current system is definitely dysfunctional. If we are going to build a new world based on equality and respect, we need that change in philosophical underpinning, not an economic system based on greed. In his book, What Then Shall We Do?, Par Alperovitz, I highly recommend it, he says that we will make the transition by simply building it. In fact, we have already started. He is keen on municipal and provincial governments and gives many examples of them taking power into their own hands through direct investment in what they want to see. If they want to revitalize their downtown, they invest in the big shopping mall at the center that will become the center of economic activity so that people can live downtown again, etc. One state even has its own bank. Margaret Rao fights for Comer, because she believes we have to reclaim the Bank of Canada to do our work for us the way it did in 1948. He is very keen on co-ops. In Ottawa, we retired folk have created the Ottawa Renewable Energy Co-op. We're investing our RSPs to build solar energy, and we're getting a 5% return on our money. Our transition group created a local food market and cafe and learning center on a cooperative model. They've invested in it, they've bought the building, and they've got these enterprises. They're for-profit co-ops. And these will become a stimulator for more economic development on a co-op model. We need to encourage our young people to employ themselves, pursuing their dreams, using their skills. They go to university and take training and environment and things like that, and then they have a hard time getting jobs. But we have to make sure they find a way to work in those fields that they've trained in. They don't have to wait for others to take the lead. There are economic models that can get them started. We can no longer afford the indulgence of despair. It's far more empowering to outline the future you most want to see and to start building it. Maude Barlow, Council of Canadians, often repeats, hope is a moral imperative. I would add, faith that your actions do make a difference is what makes it possible to hope. By getting to know our fellow activists across the country, and by getting to know our allies in our own city, by knowing who we are in the river with, we can move forward together towards healing our world. Amen. All our relations.